Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Welcome to Recalculating for Small Business. I'm David Katzmeyer, co-producer for Recalculating, filling in for your host, Don Mazzella. Don was called away from today's program, but he will return for subsequent shows. Meanwhile, your other host, Dan Perkins, is here for what is sure to be a very interesting show. Today, we'll be speaking with Alex Berlantes, co-founder and CEO of Everland Supplies, today's technology to automate mileage and expense tracking and reporting. They track your trips automatically with an easy-to-use app so you don't have to. When you go for a drive, their intelligent drive technology detects your trips automatically in the background. One may classify trips in a single swipe on a mobile device. You can generate beautiful reports effortlessly as Excel spreadsheets or PDF documents. Optimizing efficiency means that people, on average, discover more than $6,500 in tax deductions. Alex Melantes reveals how independent workers and entrepreneurs view and handle annual tax requirements set forth by the Internal Revenue Service. Alex, we welcome you to the Recalculating for Small Business program. Here to ask you a few questions is your host, Dan Perkins. Dan, over to you.
Thank you. Alex, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. That was a very generous introduction.
We try and be friends with our guests. We're not out to hurt anybody or embarrass anybody. We just like to have them have an opportunity to tell their story. I have to tell you, Alex, as I reviewed this before the show, I couldn't help but think about, and this is probably the wrong way to put it, but it's how my mind thinks. In my pocket, I have an iPhone that has a step counter, and every step I take, it counts. And at the end of the day, I look and see how many steps that I took today. Doesn't tell me where I went, didn't tell me how many steps were up the steps or down the steps, just how many steps. But I wonder if there is, in a sense, similar technology in what it is you do, is that you follow the person wherever they go. Is that a fair illustration?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's actually a pretty good analogy. I think we started the business about 2.5 years ago, and part of the insight was that, you know, my father, for example, is a novelist, and so if he's in between assignments or working on a book, he used to keep a paper mileage log, and he'd also have sort of a shoebox of receipts, and sort of those two things are required to, you know, add up all the business deductions, so I'm sure that's familiar to your listeners. And, you know, sure. At the time, you know, I was in Silicon Valley and I sort of thought, hey, you know, the smartphone seems perfect for taking care of these two things, you know, maybe you can automate it. So similar to a step counter, what an iPhone or an Android phone has, it's got a camera, of course, for the receipts, but for mileage, it has something called an accelerometer. So the phone can tell sort of how fast it's moving. And of course, it's got GPS. And so if you stitch those two things together, you can create sort of an innovative way to create an IRS compliant mileage log without needing any input from the user. So that's what we've done.
Alex, we over the course of the year and a half we've been doing this show, we've had a lot of people who have phone-based technology, and I understand it's a powerful tool. But if you wouldn't mind, Alex, I want to ask you some questions about the process of how your program evolved. I'm not a programmer. I am, in addition to being a talk show host, I'm an author too, like your father. And I'm curious, did you go out and hire a programmer? You came up with the idea and said, okay, this is what I want to do. I don't know how to do it, so I got to find somebody who's got to write me code to make it work. Tell us a little bit about how the business got started and what were the challenges of bringing your dream to market.
Yeah, great question. So around the time, you know, I was thinking about doing this, I was actually a grad student down at Stanford. And so Stanford, you know, being in the center of Silicon Valley, is sort of this hotbed of people who want to start apps or build software-based businesses. And, you know, I was talking with a lot of different programmers and sort of thinking whether I should learn more programming myself. I was a math major in college and, you know, have some inclinations that way, but realized that I wasn't the best at that. And then I got really lucky and met my co-founder, who was also a grad student there. And so we're equal partners, and he's our CTO. And so we sort of started the business, the two of us together, with him sort of taking care of you know, pretty much most of those programming obligations to start.
Mm-hmm. And so was he the guy who actually put the code together to merge all the various existing technologies? Did he write the code? Did he write the software program?
Yeah, he sure did. So he's much more talented. He's much more talented than I am. You know, sometimes people joke.
No.
You know.
So why don't you just say he just has different talents than you? Not that he's more talented. You each brought individual talents to the enterprise to form the business, and you both contributed.
Yeah, I'll take that. But you know, I think around here sometimes people sort of laugh that, you know, there is this sort of magic feeling where, you know, people turn coffee into code, and then all of a sudden you sort of have this new product that works. The other thing I would say that might be interesting to folks is that, you know, building a business starting in 2015 on software is a lot easier than building a business, you know, even in 2010. And so in the last few years, Apple's done a lot to sort of create these things called SDKs, so like software development kits, where you have a lot of pieces that can kind of function right out of the box. So we rely on things, for example, like GPS, and rather than us writing a lot of custom software to get that GPS data, right, like a latitude and a longitude, the phone already has that. Mm-hmm. And the phone already has that maybe because you want to use Google Maps, right, or maybe you want to use Yelp mm-hmm. to find a restaurant. And so developers can right. sort of rely and sort of, you know, step on the shoulders of previous developers for a lot of those things. And building a business, you know, today is so much easier than it was even just a few years ago.
That's a terrific, terrific insight because I didn't even think about in many cases, if I'm hearing what you're saying, in many cases, the black box was already invented. You just put add-ons on the black box to make it special for you.
Yeah, exactly. So a good example might be, you know, you could have a precocious high school student develop an app, and, you know, if they use something like Google Maps, all of those maps would be beautifully rendered, and they could put a pin in the map. All they needed to do was say where that pin was going to go, and then they borrowed everything else from Google, right, which is this open source repository of all that information. And so, you know, Google's business model, they want people to use that sort of stuff. But the speed at which you can build software products just keeps increasing, you know, every single year.
So our program is dedicated to small business people, men and women who are starting, building, and growing their businesses. Help them understand, when you came up with this idea, what were some of the challenges that you went through with your partner together to bring it to where it is today?
Sure. Wow. Where to even start? I mean, I think
wherever
one
you
thing
want.
That was really one thing that's really challenging for us is, you know, we didn't have our first customer pay us for about a year and a half. And so that's really challenging. So our business model, you know, I think, you know, different than, you know, some other businesses, you have to sort of pre-fund a lot of the research and development. So before you can start selling the product, You just need to be building, you need to be marketing. We also have a freemium business model. So Everlance is completely free to use. The idea is you should track as many receipts as you like, as many miles as you want, and then you'll pay us for automation. And so we want to give that value away for free, and then we hope that you tell your friends about it. So that's, in a way, you can think of that as that's our sales and marketing, right? So we give away a free product and support the server costs in exchange for that. And then we hope that a portion of those people will find that additional value of either linking their credit card, which can make the product better, right? So rather than collecting all those receipts, you can just link your credit card, or we'll want automation for mileage tracking. So the app can learn, you know, that whenever you go from your home to your office, that should be a commute, or whenever you go from an office to a client site, you know, that should be marked as a business deduction. And so I think that's a powerful business model, but it takes a long time in order to get close to cash flow profitability. And I think there's a lot of risk there. So it takes time to build the product, and then premium, you know, membership kind of converts over time. So I think that was a challenge where, you know, you feel like you're kind of flying blind a little bit. You know, I think having interactions with a customer and repetition with a customer, especially paying customers, is the strongest source of validation. Those are the best signals. Like, you know, imagine if I were running a retail shop, talking to someone and sort of figuring out, hey, are the people walking into the store buying our product? Like, that would be so important. And for us, you know, we almost didn't, you know whether that was going to be the case until 2 years later. So I think finding ways to have de-risk that earlier would have been really powerful for us. So trying to sell at least a piece of it, or, you know, get a stronger signal. I mean, thankfully it's all working out. I think sometimes, especially, you know, around here in San Francisco, there's sort of this, you know, build it and they will come attitude. And I think that really hurts a lot of entrepreneurs.
Right. So is the Small Business Administration, in a lot of their research at looking at why small businesses fail, you somewhat address that, because they say that it isn't because the idea is not without merit. It's that the reason why so many small businesses fail is that they are undercapitalized. They don't have enough money to see them through the lean time while they're trying to build the business. And it sounded to me like you said maybe as much as 2 years before you had your proof of concept that people would in fact pay for what you're doing. Is that true?
Yeah, it's true in a way. And that's a really interesting thing you just shared. I wonder whether that people don't plan correctly, you know, so like, you know, it takes longer to get to profitability than they think, or whether they're undercapitalized from the start. That would be an interesting statistic to learn more about. But in our case, what we did have was an app in the App Store with a lot of users and engagement. And so we sort of released this free app. And then, you know, within a few months, we had thousands of people using the app every single day. And we were able to use that sort of proof point to go to investors and say, hey, look, people are really engaging with our product. You know, we're not making any money today, but we know there's something there. You know, we haven't spent any money marketing. They've gone out and found our product. They're telling their friends about their product. We think this is a mission critical thing for them. You know, we're kind of becoming kind of like their financial system of record, and really helping them stay organized, get prepared for taxes, save money. I think another thing that the Small Business Administration cites as a statistic is that people that are use accounting software or use a bookkeeper are something like 40% more likely to succeed. So, you know, I think we're similar to that. You know, that if you're using something like Everlance, you know, you're more on top of your finances, and so you know whether you're going to have a cash crunch or whether you're going to run out of money in a few months or how profitable your business really is. But to return to the question, you know, what we did is we had that proof point of engagement, and then we went to investors and said, hey, there's still some risk in the business. Are you willing to take a bet on us? Give us some money, and then that'll essentially allow us to fund the next leg, which is to see whether people will pay for this and whether we can sort of build a business that is cash flow positive.
how again, going back to challenges, how difficult is it to start a business when the business model has a free product and a premium upgrade? How difficult was it to begin to transfer those people from free to paying a premium? What did you enhance to do to make the premium desirable on the part of the free users?
Yeah, I think it's a really big challenge. And I think also, you know, for us, the way we thought about it is the only asset that our company really had at that point outside of the technology was this sort of brand and trust with their end users. So to have these at that point, I think we probably had 100,000 users, but to sort of flip the script on them and say, hey, now this product that you've been, you know, you thought was free and you've been using with the expectation that it's free is now paid. Like that would just not be something we'd want to do, as the managers of the business. And we thought it, you know, would be kind of horrible for our brand and a horrible experience for them. So what we challenge ourselves to do is, could we add an additional few features and sort of have those be beyond the paywall? And so, you know, everything that you're currently getting will continue to be free. But by the way, there's some extra bells and whistles, and we're going to charge for those. And that's how we're going to build a business. And so I think that worked well for us. It's scary because, you know, right when you do that, at least for us, the revenue didn't, you know, just flow in right away, right? Because you have to sort of slowly teach people about those features and they adopt over time. It's not a one-way thing. You know, we weren't offering people handcuffs. We were just sort of offering them, reasons to use that extra product. But, you know, we think, you know, over time that's more powerful, especially because, you know, the engaged users were telling their friends about it, which kept, I think the plus side of a freemium model is the top of the funnel is so much bigger. You know, there's just so many more users trying your product, telling their friends about the product, and the amount of inertia it takes to overcome to try your product is really small. You know, people sort of see the product and they're like, hey, it's free. Why not give this a shot? You know, and also I think because it's an app, there's this sense that you can kind of get started in a few minutes and check it out without too much risk of time or money.
So how did you and have you changed as to how you acquire prospects?
Yeah, great question. So the word of mouth, that's been our number one source, and it continues to grow. So that's great. We'd expect it to kind of continue to grow with, you know, as our company gets bigger and bigger. Another thing that worked really well for us in the beginning was just really a lucky break, which is we were featured a few times by Apple. So Apple will do sort of like, you know, an app of the week or a spotlight on the finance or business category. So we were chosen for that. So that's kind of like a stroke of lightning. I think we worked hard. And I think we also really focused on user experience, design, and sort of making, you know, at the time I think most business apps and, finance apps were kind of more designed by accountants. They didn't feel that friendly to use. They didn't feel that quick and easy. And so I think our app sort of stood out there and allowed us to get featured. But that's really kind of like a sugar spike. You know, you see a big jump of users and then it sort of collapses down. So you think you're a genius that week. And then, you know, the week afterwards, you're kind of depressed because, you know, that surge of users left. But what happens in the interim is your base keeps building, you know, and it just exposes you to more and more segments. You know, so for us, when we started, we never thought, for example, real estate agents would be a great category of users for us. It turns out, you know, there's over 1 million real estate agents. They're all independent contractors, and they're in the car all the time working with clients. And so they, you know, they really had this pain point of keeping a mileage log. And then lo and behold, we're seeing all these customer support tickets from real estate agents and questions and and so now we have a, you know, we listened to that, and that was kind of an exciting, you know, happy break. And this year, for example, we're partnering with Realogy. So Realogy is a public company that owns Coldwell Banker and Century 21 and Sotheby's and a few other brands. And so, you know, the two of us will work together to share Everlands with their members, and we'll give their members a discount In exchange, we get access to, you know, even more members as part of sort of a user education thing. And so that's really great for us. So I think, you know, as the business is evolving.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, as the business is evolving, you know, we think partnerships will be a bigger and bigger channel for us. So, you know, at first, I think if you don't have any credibility, the partner is like, hey, like, you know, there's a lot of software products, you know, and you know, we can't tell our members about everything. And then, you know, slowly, you know, you just get bigger, you get more reviews, the user base grows, you make a few partnerships. And then it seems like, you know, instead of, you're kind of pushing the boulder uphill, and then all of a sudden it starts to roll downhill for once. And so that's a really nice moment.
So what's the, what does it cost to acquire your service?
How much does it cost us to acquire a user, or how much does it cost a user to get up on it?
What does it cost a user to use your service?
Yeah, so Everlance is you can use it completely for free, but if you want the automation, so that's bank and credit card integration or completely automatic mileage tracking, that's either $8 a month if you pay month to month, or $60 a year if you pay annually. So you know, we think that's a very fair price, and it's also tax deductible for most people. So that's one product. Mm-hmm. But another product that we're starting to see a lot of traction with is actually small businesses and teams at enterprises that are using our same technology for reimbursement. So, for example, we have clients that have construction companies, home health. You know, there's a variety of people that have workers in the field, and they need to reimburse them for their mileage, and previously they just sort of relied on them to do it on pen and paper. And, you know, that's a frustrating experience for the employee. They're filling out, you know, all this sort of documentation. And then for the business owner, you know, there's no real data behind, you know, how much money is going out. You know, so if a business owner or manager is reimbursing someone for a trip, they know how much the flight costs, they have a receipt, they know how much the meal at the restaurant costs. You know, they have some context on that, but for a lot of people, they might be reimbursing employees, you know, $400 or $600 a month for their mileage, and there's no documentation or evidence. And so they see our app and like, oh, wow, there's these GPS maps. Everyone saves a lot of time. And so they see a lot of ROI for that, and that product is more expensive.
So right now, you're depending primarily on word of mouth and endorsement, or whatever the right term is, to acquire?
Word of mouth, partnerships, I'd say. You know, that's kind of like the broader category. And then another thing that works really well for us is App Store search. And so people will actually, you know, sort of take out their smartphone and think, hey, you know, there's got to be an app for this, right? Kind of like the equivalent of a Google search, you know. And then they'll search for keywords that we do very well with. So they might search for, you know, IRS mileage log, or, you know, receipts, or small business tax deductions. And, you know, as time has gone on, we sort of have continued to move up the rankings, I think, because we have a lot of reviews and we're highly rated. We're currently the highest rated mileage and expense tracker in the App Store. And so we've really stayed focused on that, because we realized that having those high ratings has translated to us getting more customers.
Right. We're coming close to the end of our time here, but I just wanted to say to you that after the show, we would like the opportunity to chat with you offline about some services that we're providing for other people that might help you grow your business a little bit faster. So right now, why don't you give everybody your website again?
Yeah. Our website is just everlance.com. So that's everlance.com. And another really great way to find our service is just to take out your smartphone, Google or Apple, and just search in the App Store for Everlance.
Okay, terrific. We've been speaking with Alex Marlantis, co-founder and CEO of Everlance, a wonderful piece of software that small businesses should be looking at. And I want to thank you, Alex, for joining with us. And if you'll stay on for just a moment after we finish this segment, we'll exchange some contact information. And if you didn't hear all of Alex's interview, you can certainly listen to it on our website, downloading at recalculating.biz, not only hear Alex's interview, but any other interviews that we've done over the last year and a half. So again, Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, guys.
Marcus Lemonis, J.D. Powers, and John Scully, and 100 other presidents and experts contributed to Recalculating the Book. Why did all these people agree to contribute to the book? I'm Don Mazzella, and I'm the editorial director of Small Business Digest. And for 20 years, we have been offering small business leaders information and data to increase profits. Recalculating the Book was named the best small business book by the Independent Press Association. Whether you need help with marketing, staffing, finance, operations, technology, or many other subjects, they're all here in Recalculating the Book. They're now available at Amazon at a reduced cost. We've also created the radio program Recalculating on recalculating.biz.
Dan Perkins here from recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here for Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. People are concerned about the massive hack to computer systems that took place in over 150 nations just a few weeks ago. Were you protected? So here's the tip of the day. Close the windows and doors in your computer. If the windows and doors are locked, the bad guys can't get in. And the best way to lock the windows and doors in your computer is to turn it off when you're done for the day. If you leave the computer on 24/7, bad guys can attack you when you are asleep or away. You lock the doors and windows of your home when you leave home, don't you? So lock the doors and windows of your computer. If you have employees, make sure they turn off their computers when they leave for the day. Make sure you set your computers to automatic download for system updates. That way you will always have the most recent operating system. Just turn off the computers and you'll have a new title, the head of cybersecurity for your business. Go to recalculating.biz for more helpful tips. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating Small Business Tip of the Day.
My co-host, Dan Perkins, is off on assignment today, but we're fortunate enough to have Sean Spiker of Hi-Tech with us today to talk about what many small businesses often have to do, pivoting from their original direction and moving in a much different direction. Sean Spiker of Hi-Tech, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don. Glad to be here.
Sean, first, tell us a little bit about yourself personally, and then a little bit about Hi-Tech.
I'm a sales guy. So I've been in this industry for going on 14 years. So this is something where my hobby brought me into the business. I was familiar with the radio control hobby and enjoyed RC cars growing up and then transitioned into RC airplanes and just always had a kind of a passion and just an enjoyment out of that hobby and knew the products in that industry and got to be familiar with the name of Hi-Tech You know, even as a teenager, I was using a high-tech product, and kind of funny that so many years later, I'd end up working for the company.
Let me interrupt you here for a moment. You said the hobby. What was your hobby, and what did high-tech do at that point?
Okay. No, good question. So the radio control hobby. So a lot of us out there in our youth played with radio control cars, and these aren't the cars you'd necessarily get from the Toys R Us or Radio Shack, which are both out of business now. But these are ones you put together from a kit. You had to buy a radio system separately, install that, and the performance was much higher. So it was beyond what a toy would be. And so played with those and raced those growing up. And then also there's the RC airplanes, which you know, some people see or some people are familiar with, where they're out flying, you know, either fairly small, you know, airplanes that are maybe 2 to 3 feet up to 6 to 7, 8 foot airplanes, radio control airplanes, and they're big models, and they fly just like a real airplane, but there's a skill in not only flying them, but building them, repairing them, but it is truly a hobby. They're not just toys. So that's the hobby I was in growing up. And so I got to be familiar with the high-tech brand, and the high-tech brand made radios for both cars and the airplanes, and also high-tech makes a lot of servos. So I used a lot of high-tech servos growing up also, and that's what led me to kind of just fall into this market.
Let me jump a little bit and ask for further explanation. Servers are what moves the flaps, et cetera. And will you explain that a little bit for our audience?
Sure. So a servo is a electric motor with a gearbox attached to it, and usually a servo responds to a signal to go to a certain position. So on the steering of a radio control car, when you move the stick or the wheel on your radio, it corresponds and moves the wheels of the car to a certain position, just like you were in a real car and turn the steering wheel and your front tires move. The same with an airplane, like you mentioned. The servo can operate a flap or an elevator, an aileron, a rudder, to where you move the stick and the servo moves that control surface to a certain position relative to how much you move the stick. So it's a motor with a gearbox. It can be fast, it can be slow, it can have a lot of torque. It just depends upon the application, but it is a geared motor.
Okay, so high tech is one of the leaders in that area in the hobby world. And now
they've hired you
and have decided to go in a different direction. Now tell us what that different direction was.
So, well, the direction is outside of the hobby end user. And it's not that I was hired to find these customers. These customers were already there. Because of the quality of the product, our servos were being used outside of just the RC cars and trucks and airplanes. They were being used in industrial applications, in military applications, medical applications, simply because they worked well, they were easy to use, they were easy to acquire, and they were relatively inexpensive. These companies didn't have to go out and reinvent the wheel, so to speak. They say, look, hey, this servo will move this component to what we need. It's already ready to go. All we do is install it and give it the correct voltage and the correct signal. So these customers were already there, but it's more a matter of tailoring to the needs of these industrial non-hobby customers and also developing the products to more of what the non-hobby customer is looking for versus just the hobby market.
That's a great explanation. This program is for small business leaders. 59% of our audience, we found, are presidents and or owners. Now, having said that, Can you go into a little bit of the history as to why high-tech decided to pivot like it has?
Well, you know, since 1983, high-tech has been in the radio control industry, manufacturing the servos and the radios and other things for the hobby. The hobby grew throughout those years, and high-tech got bigger. We developed more products. But at some point, the hobby market stopped growing. And inside of this, all these years, we were selling to these other companies that were outside of the hobby market. And it got to be where it was recognized, this is where the growth is going to be going forward. So these are the customers we need to start tailoring the product to, start speaking with and communicating with, determining what their needs are in the future, and also maintain and grow those relationships with those non-hobby customers for us to continue to be successful as a company. So in 2017, we did make an official split, creating High-Tech Commercial Solutions, a division of High-Tech RCD, and that's to service the needs, the sales, the development, the product development of these non-hobby customers. And, you know, every day we talk to somebody who has used our product in the past and like, well, we want to use your product here, but we need it to do this. And so it's up to our engineers and the servo team to go back and say, yes, we can do this. But what's most important is communicating with those customers to really truly determine what needs they have for our product, make sure their expectations are within reason of what the product can provide, and managing that relationship going forward. One of the key differences between the hobby market versus the industrial market is delivery is key. So we're dealing with a company that is manufacturing another product, and they have deadlines, they have schedules, they have contracts that they are working with other companies that, yes, this product needs to be built by a certain day. So delivery is key. When we talk to a customer and say, yes, the lead time is this, we need to make sure that we can meet those deadlines so it doesn't put our own customer into a bind with their customer. So it is different from the hobby market in that expectation, to where the hobby user is like, you know, when's it going to show up into the hobby store? When's it going to show up online? Versus, you know, I've got a production line down. I've got hundreds of employees sitting around idle because they can't build their product because they're waiting on ours. So the expectations and the requirements of the customer is much different in the industrial business market versus the hobby market.
So if I heard you correctly, one is prior to this, if someone would come to you and integrate your product into their product and then move forward, you are in effect going out and talking directly to the ultimate user. And two, if I heard you correctly, you're saying first you had to figure out could you meet the deadlines. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, it's just that the deadlines become so much more important when you're dealing with another company's production line of installing our product into the product they're building. So managing those deadlines, managing the expectations of the customer as far as when product will be delivered and meeting those goals has become a much more important part of our business and the part of the commercial side of the business that needs to be met, that needs to be a constant communication between us and the customer. It's not just, yeah, here's the product, here it is, it's going to be on the shelves. It's, no, here's the delivery date of the product. Here's the delivery date of the product that was customized for your use. And, you know, this is the delivery dates going forward. So it's just a different type of experience dealing with the customer when it is the non-hobby market.
That's very true. And how did you go about making what is oftentimes a very difficult transition?
It was a slow process. It's not something that can be really rushed, but we recognize that certain product lines are going to be just for the commercial side. So we started making that transition. Certain components that don't necessarily affect or are needed in the hobby market being integrated into our products. We did change, we moved to a different office, separated the two, different warehouses, things like that. But it is a slow process. There still is some intermingling of resources, things like that, to where, we might have to go to the other office where something is stored. But it is a process like anything else. It's not overnight. It is something that you add to as you go along. A year from now, we'll probably be 99.9% separate. But right now, it's still an ongoing transition, and it's never easy. Change is never easy. Moving is never easy, but in the end, it's going to be very, very much worthwhile.
Well, as the face of the company, what are some of the difficulties you ran into, and how did you overcome them?
Some of the difficulties that we've encountered in this transition is the new technologies that have not been, not necessarily invented, but haven't been utilized in the product. Recognizing that the market is looking for different ways to communicate with our product. So having to go to the engineers and say, instead of using this protocol, we need to be able to use this protocol, things like that. And the most difficult part in something like that is not every customer is consistent. With the hobby market, this was the way you did it, and that was just understood. Now, in the commercial market, where you're dealing with thousands and thousands of engineers and differences of opinions on how to get something done, or just new and innovative ways to do something, the need for developing and staying on top of technology is the difference between life and death of your company. So staying on top of trends, staying on top of what the market's doing, what our customers are doing, what the future needs of the customer are, and that just involves communicating with the customers, communicating the market, staying on top of where the technology is going, and making some pretty bold decisions on where we think those markets are headed and what technologies are going to be utilized. So it's just a matter of you can't sit back and rest on what you have. You have to continue to develop it. So that really is the challenge. Where's the market going to go? What technologies are going to be utilized? How do we integrate those into our products?
Are you going into the robotics market as well?
That is a big part of it. We've been in the robotics market, and there's quite a few different types of robotics markets. There's the industrial production, the types of robots you see in the videos, assembling cars, things like that. There's the educational robotics, where middle schools and high schools are in contests, and they're using servos, and they have challenges that they have to do every year. And then there's just general robotics. It could be animatronics. It could be theme parks. We're involved in most of all that, heavily involved in the educational robotics. We're getting more involved in the animatronics, more involved in the industrial servo actuators that are on assembly lines, things like that. So we're continuing to grow. These are all huge growth markets for us. And so it's just a matter of developing the product and having the product that is the best in that category for that price range in those markets.
Well, let's talk a little bit about high tech in general. What is the corporate culture and what is the corporate ethics that you project out to your clients?
Good question. So, you know, I still consider us a small company. So a small, very personal company where we can be reached phone call, email, almost at any time. And, you know, most of the customers have my cell phone, but value, just ethics as far as, you know, we're supplying, we're being honest every step of the way. We're manufacturing a product that we can stand behind. You know, it's a family culture to where we get together with the owner of the company. We get together with the different divisions of the company. So, you know, we have divisions in Korea and Germany. And so we're constantly meeting with these different divisions, you know, almost on a daily basis to communicate together direction, where we're going, what we're developing, how we're selling that. You know, a lot of times, you know, the world is getting smaller and smaller all the time. You know, we might be dealing with the same customer over in Germany as we are here, and what the needs of those customers are, how can we better service those customers. So it is still a small business, and that does allow us to react quicker and make adjustments, make changes. So just being an honest, hardworking company that puts a valuable product out there that we can stand behind, that we can believe in, that really is the culture. And to provide the best service, just like we were dealing with another family member, we want to do what's best for our product, for their product, and make sure that relationship continues going forward. So kind of a long-winded explanation, but that's how I see it. I see it as a small, family-oriented company that wants to put a better product on the market for a better price.
Well, you know, Sean, the more you let the prospect talk, the better the chances of success. But, Sean, tell us the websites. Now, there's two different websites, so please explain the differences.
Okay, so one of the websites is directed for the hobby market. And so you'll see all the different servos, the different transmitters. You'll see the airplanes.
Tell us that website and spell it out for our audience.
Yep. So the hobby website is going to be hitechrcd.com. So hitechrcd.com. And that's going to basically show if you are a hobbyist and you want to go see what the product line is, whether it's the newest servos, whether it's the newest foam airplanes, you're going to find all that there. You're going to find all the information for service and support, the different product categories, where the team members are, the team drivers, the team pilots, where they might be going next. So something that's going to be clearly driven and clearly targeted to the radio control hobby and the end users in the radio control hobby. The other website is going to be, for the high-tech commercial solutions, is going to be high-tech, so H-I-T-E-C, and then N-O-L-O-G-Y. So that's hightechnology.com. And that brings you to the high-tech commercial solutions website. And you're going to see the different categories. So we've got the servo actuators, but we're also in the drone services industry. So we're going to have very shortly a survey drone on the market, and that's going to be on the website too. But right now it's going to be mostly the different sizes and classes of servo actuators, whether just based upon the smallest or the biggest, but there's some that are continuous rotation, waterproof, and we're continuing to develop more and more servos every year. In fact, we'll be at a trade show next week showcasing a lot of the new technologies there, higher voltages, different protocols. So the this right now is probably the most rapid development of new technologies in the servo market for us that we've ever seen. And what is still a benefit for the hobby side is there is a trickle down of these new technologies. So something that we come along that we incorporate into the new servos that it just makes vast improvements can be incorporated into the hobby side. And the further we get along with it, the price comes down. So, you know, even the hobby user can benefit from these new developments and these new technologies that comes from the industrial side.
Well, Sean, let me interrupt you. You said you're going to have a drone available. Did I hear that right?
That is correct. And when you hear the word drone, most people think of the quadcopters and the multirotors. But drone is a bigger definition than that. So drone also involves fixed-wing airplanes. So we're about to introduce to the market the Zeno FX, which is a fixed-wing survey drone. And the advantage of a fixed wing is it's able to fly longer and cover more distance for a mission. And people are buying drones not for the drone itself, but for the data and the information they can get from that drone. For example, with a survey drone, it might be for agriculture, where they're flying over vast farms, and we're talking, you know, you could have, or most farms are going to be thousands and thousands of acres. So you need a vehicle that can cover these large areas doing survey missions, or it is using sensors that provide moisture levels. They can look for certain types of things in the crops. They can look for funguses. So it's getting this data that's going to be beneficial to the farmers, and they can know how to better water, to better fertilize, to or whether over-fertilizing. And they can do it quickly and easily with a survey drone like the Zeno FX.
Well, let me explore that further, only because it's of personal interest. So you're going to provide a drone with like a camera or sensors, or do people install their own equipment or sensors to do this?
So we would actually provide the different sensors. So it's a modular payload where the sensor will snap in and snap out of the vehicle, depending on what they're doing. So it could be just a more simple survey type camera that takes RGB pictures, or it could be a specific type of sensor that's looking for specific spectrums of light to detect certain things in crops. It depends on what the customer's needs really are. So again, it goes back to communicating with the customer, determining what they're trying to get. Because again, they're not buying the drone. They're buying the data that the drone can combine, that the drone can provide. So communicating with the customer and determining what that is.
That's an excellent point. But can I ask, what is the starting price point on such a drone as that?
Something in this, or something like the Zeno FX, it's going to be around $6,000 to $7,000 is the starting price.
Yeah. Well, Sean, your commercial, we're almost out of time. Your commercial website, again, for people?
It's going to be hitechnology.com. That's HITECNOLOGY.com.
Well, a link to that website will be on our recalculating.biz website tonight. Sean, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been illuminating.
My pleasure. Don, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Tell me, Dan, tell me about your latest book.
My current book that's coming out, I should say, is Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? And it's really the first book written for children between the ages of 9 and 12 and their families dealing with dementia. Dementia is a growing problem with the elderly in the United States and around the world. And we are very well not very well informed about what's going on, what's happening. So I wrote this book in the form of a mystery. And I have two little girls, 9 and 12, who have a magical power to be able to seem to be able to find things that are lost. And so they go to their dads and moms and they say, you know, we work all over the neighborhood helping people find things, and we seem to find things. And their dad says, yes, you have a magical talent to do that. And they said, we'd like to start a business to see if we can help other people. So they decided to start a business. The two girls' name are Hudson and Charlotte. And they start H&C's Lost and Found. If you've lost it, we find it. And so they build a business, and they convince the dads to build them an office and a treehouse in the backyard. And they get busy making posters and flyers trying to get customers. And their dads take them downtown, and they put them in the windows and on the telephone poles and light poles. And they go home, and first week goes by, and nobody comes. And the second week and third week, and nobody comes. They're really, really dejected. And the fourth week comes, and there's a knock at the door. And they walk over and open the door, and there's a young man standing there with one of their flyers in his hands. And he says to them, my dad says the reason why my Grammy can't remember me is because she's lost her memory. And your flyer says you find things that are lost. Can you find my Grammy's memory? Well, they don't know anything about memory. So they take his name and they go see their dads to see what can happen. And the story evolves into how they learn about what dementia is and what's going on in the body when somebody has dementia. And then they decide, while they can't find their customer's memory, they can help him build the tools to retain her in his memory. And so at the end of the book, there are about 10 to 12, 13 things that families can do together to work on to preserve the memory of grandma and grandpa so the generations can know who these people were. And that's the story.
What a great book. When will it be available, and how can people get it?
Well, it'll be available on Amazon.com. A lot of people who have read it, who've had moms and dads that have been stricken with Alzheimer's and dementia, tell me that they really now begin to understand what's happening in grandma's brain. And we took a different approach. Rather than do the typical brain cross-section, I work with the artist, and we design highways in the brain. And there's a brain of one of the little girls and the brain of Grammy. They both have highways, roads. But where the girl's brain, everything is green and go. Grammy's brain is full of no left turns, do not enter, stop, no right turns. So all of the messages that need to come from our brain get screwed up and we can't function. Great illustrations, though. Wonderful illustrations.
Well, say goodbye, Dan.
All right.
Time for us to go.
Thank you for joining us. And by the way, if you didn't hear all of today's show, you can go to recalculating.biz. And you can pick up this show and past shows to expand your knowledge as becoming more successful entrepreneurs. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Well, Dan, what do you think about today's guest?
I thought they were terrific. We had great diversity. We had some really good ideas on small business and what they can do with credit and how they can save money with the gentleman from Spent. So I think there was a lot of good stuff. Again, continuing the idea that we are on the air to try and help small businesses grow their businesses and start them. And again, we had content today that dealt with both. And as in the past, if you didn't get all of this show, you can go to our website, recalculating.biz, and look at past shows and expand your education. How you can be better at what you're doing in a small business.
Agreed. Great show, Dan.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.